This is your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Sorry about that last-minute start or the late start. I'm actually hosting from KRCB in Rohnert Park, taking care of a loved one up here, and unfortunately we're having some technical problems on our side. So we're going to start with me on the phone, and then hopefully we'll reconnect. So I hope this is sounding okay. Today we are talking about a new documentary called Crime and Punishment. It chronicles the struggles of New York police officers and a lawsuit that they filed to expose the department's race-based quota system. In April of 2016, 12 Black and Latino police officers with the NYPD sat for an interview to talk about this system with NBC New York, and the retaliation happened almost immediately. They say that they are explicitly told to arrest people of color between the ages of 14 and 21. And joining us to talk about the film is Stephen Meng, an Emmy-nominated documentary filmmaker and visual journalist based in Brooklyn. And Stephen joins us in studio. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Richie Baez, a member of the NYPD for 14 years. Richie spent his entire career working in the 40th precinct in the South Bronx, and he is one of the NYPD 12. Hi, Richie. Thank you for joining us. Well, Stephen, I want to start off with you. This film is incredible. I mean, you have direct access to these police officers. You're with them at home. You're with them in meetings. When did you first learn about this groundbreaking lawsuit?
Well, the lawsuit emerged several years after my producing partner and I had been working on some more journalistic projects about policing issues in New York City. You know, for a little background, in those early projects for some other publications, we had been filming with silhouetted police informants. And in around 2014, which was supposed to be a reform year with the election of a reform mayor, Bill de Blasio, and his appointment of a supposed reform police commissioner, William Bratton, things did not actually seem to be changing as much as they were purported to. And so we were hearing it a lot in the communities and in law enforcement circles. And so those individuals who were silhouetted at the time, Adil Polanco and Pedro Serrano, to name two of them, had decided they wanted to be more transparent about their battle against the department and share the process of their pushing back and fighting this fight to really expose and have a true reform moment around the issue of quotas, corruption, and the discriminatory impact on minority communities. And so that was a very important opportunity that I felt needed to be followed for another 4 years, and then led to the formation of the class action lawsuit.
And Richie, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, how are you guys doing? Great. Thank you so much for joining us. Richie, in the film, one of your colleagues, Officer Pedro Serrano, who's been with the NYPD for 9 years, he was told specifically that he had to stop Black people between the ages of 14 and 21. And he said, no, I will not do this. And as a result, he said he got suspended. What have you been told specifically about quotas?
Well, basically, they told us that they want a certain amount of summonses a month and certain amounts of arrests per month. And that's the number. Like, I can give you an example. Like, they want one arrest and 20 summonses in a month.
And Richie, in the film, you say that this job from the beginning, you felt, was not about helping people. It was about numbers. And you also said that you always spoke your mind. What happened when you spoke your mind?
What happened? Basically, it was never good when I spoke my mind. What happened would be they put me on in areas that I cannot produce any type of numbers. They'll put me in a hospital. They'll put me in a fixed post. something called a Sky Watch. They'll put me in prisoner transports. Like anything that they'll give to somebody that's what we'll call a rookie, they'll give it to jobs that normally is reserved for them. They was giving it to me. So that's what they was giving me, and also like bad evaluation, so forth and so on.
Steven, what else stood out for you when you spoke with officers about what they were told to do in terms of quotas, the specific people that they were told to arrest?
Well, what really stood out to me was that this was not like an individual case, or what, you know, some in the department might push back as saying, well, this is just a disgruntled cop or the quote-unquote bad apple, and so you can't take his or her word for it. I was hearing from so many cops, beyond just the NYPD 12, I mean, many others who ultimately were concerned about coming forward and going on record. But, you know, the consistent notion was that in these economically disenfranchised communities, officers were often being pressured to target minorities as a result for meeting the quota. This idea of discretion immediately goes out the window when you have to meet a work productivity measurement, as they call it. You know, we understand that, you know, workplace managers need to ensure that their employees are, you know, doing their job, are working hard. But when it comes to quotas, and in particular with policing, the mission of policing, you know, to protect and serve, is in direct conflict with the idea of activity measurements and performance standards, as the NYPD's quota-based system has mandated.
You've got some pretty damning statistics in your piece. Over $900 million of New York City's annual budget comes from the revenue generated by summonses, fines, and arrest-related fees. And also, between 2007 and 2015, the NYPD made over 900,000 false summonses and arrests that were later dismissed for lack of probable cause. 900,000 between 2007 and 2015.
Yeah, so the second statistic comes directly from the Stinson versus New York City class action lawsuit on the part of civilians. You know, the NYPD 12's lawsuit is historic because it is the first class action built around active duty officers in the department. And, you know, one of the things that their very courageous efforts to speak about these issues that are not just impacting them in terms of retaliation and sort of like completely destroyed career growth in the department, but it is about their other colleagues in the rank and file who are on the receiving end of very harmful practices that the community then grows to have a great you know, antipathy for. And so what their you know, unbelievable many years of effort to expose some of these issues has revealed is that when you look closely, there's a tremendous amount of revenue coming into the city as a result of criminal summonses and arrests that could be related to a situation like, say, when you look at Pedro Hernandez, a young man who spent 12 months in Rikers. In his case, when there's a tremendous – that is an example of the tremendous pressure that individuals who are not empowered with powerful attorneys to take a guilty plea. When you take the guilty plea, not just in New York City but throughout the nation, what you are agreeing to then is an exposure to a whole menu of revenue-generating fines, you know, fees, bails, bail revenue, possible asset forfeitures that all told contribute to these high, high revenue numbers that the city ultimately is expecting, because this is a small occupying army when you think of the number 36,000 uniformed officers in New York City. And the city and the department has to be able to justify that many officers that are flooding the streets and the $5.6 billion annual operating budget that they require. And so one of those things that creates a very structural problem that would take incredible political willpower to change is the link to revenue generation and the mission of policing. And so that's something that the NYPD 12, the private investigator, and the families that have fought back against the system have really staggeringly exposed in this film.
Are joined by Stephen Meng, who is the filmmaker behind the new documentary Crime and Punishment. And we're also joined by Richie Baez. He's been a member of the NYPD for 14 years. He spent his entire career working in the 40th precinct in the South Bronx. And he's one of the 12 officers who is suing the NYPD over race-based quotas. Richie, what happened exactly in 2010 when the quota system was outlawed? Because that got a lot of attention. Did you see any changes?
No. Basically, the changes that happened was the words. They said performance enhancement or productivity goals. They used those words interchangeably to mean quotas. So as long as they don't have the word quota written behind in front of it, they basically, we could basically skate around the law. So that's what they've been doing for the last, until recently. They basically changed the wording. They basically put a memo after our film came out saying that anybody uses the word quota or in performance or productivity metrics will be punished. Has to be reported and will be punished.
And what conversations happened behind the scenes when the 2010 change was supposed to take place?
Well, basically they said this: if you want to go anywhere, you have to come in with numbers. Period. If you don't come in with numbers, you have to come in with summonses and arrests. If you don't come in with those summonses and arrests, You can't go to any type of details you want to go. They say you want to go to anti-crime. They go want to go to ESU, Emergency Service Unit, with other departments, of course, SWAT, so forth and so on. So the more arrests and summonses you bring in, the more unlikely you'll get accepted into these specialized units.
Well, let's hear a clip from the first sit-down interview you all did with NBC New York. And in this clip, you will hear from today's guest, Officer Richie Baez. You'll also hear from Officers Pedro Serrano, Derek Waller, Adhil Polanco, Edwin Raymond, Kareem Abdullah, and Felicia Whitley. You'll also hear from former NYD Commissioner Bill Bratton and the NYPD officer's attorney, Chukwuemeka Nwokorow. And this is the first interview that the NYPD 12 did with NBC New York in 2 years ago, April 2016. Here's the clip.
They tell you this to your face. Black Hispanics between 14 to 21. They must get stopped.
They're plaintiffs in a federal class action lawsuit that claims the NYPD is violating a 2010 state ban on quotas, speaking out together for the first time.
At the end of the month, these officers, whoever don't have that arrest or those few summonses, they're pressured to find something. You might not see nothing. You're supposed to be visible. You might not see anything, but you go hunting, like bounty hunting for an arrest, locking up some old guy, some homeless guy, finding somebody who's riding a bicycle on the sidewalk, who's spinning, and you bring him in.
The problem is when you go hunting, when you put any type of numbers on a police officer to perform, we are going to go to the most vulnerable.
The most vulnerable.
Of course. We're going to go to LGBT community. We're going to go to the black community. We're going to go to those people that have no vote, that have no power. If we start doing what we're doing in Midtown Manhattan, a phone call to the mayor's office is going to be made. That's going to be the end of it.
We're the predators, they're the prey. The worst thing you can have is a police officer that needs an arrest for the month.
So you're all minorities. How does that make you feel?
It's horrible.
This is something coming from the top that trickles its way down, and this is why we're all here today.
We first interviewed Officer Edwin Raymond last month. He says he's been recording conversations with NYPD officials for the past 2 years in an effort to prove alleged quotas and retaliation against cops who don't rack up numbers.
They're breaking the law.
Raymond's claims elicited this expletive from the police commissioner.
Bullshit is my response to that.
The commissioner insists his policies are focused on the quality of arrests and summonses, not the quantity, the officer's attorney.
Is the commissioner lying?
Yes. Commissioner Bratton is lying.
How can you prove this?
I can prove it with testimony, with recordings, with documents.
All they want us to do is go out there and lock them up. They told us it's easy to get numbers out here because you work in this type of community.
Are you arresting for stuff that you shouldn't be arresting for?
Well, that's why we're here. We don't do it. We refuse. And because of that, we are retaliated against.
Because you're not harassing people, you're being punished. You know? And it doesn't make for a great work environment because they want you to harass people.
The lawsuit claims minority officers are punished more severely than white cops for failing to meet quotas. The city denies it.
And the community are suffering the most.
Because?
Because the pressure, because the quota. Because the police department is like a whore pretending to be a lady. That's what they are.
Are you worried? You know, this is a big step to come forward like this.
It's not easy. It's not easy. We are the enemies. We are the people that nobody talk to. The culture of the department, we are the rats. That's how they call us. We are the rats that speak out. It takes a lot of guts from a rat to stand where we stand, knowing that our career are basically over the second we speak against such a mafia. Because the police department is a mafia. It's a big organized mafia.
And that is a clip from the NYPD 12 police officers who filed a class action lawsuit against the NYPD to expose and end the department's race-based quota system. And they all decided to sit down with NBC New York in April 2016. And the documentary Crime and Punishment tells the story of the officers and the lawsuit, and you can see it on Hulu on August 24th. You can also check out their website for community screenings and theater screenings across the country. And before we go to break, I wanted to ask you, Richie, you have been a member of the NYPD for 14 years. You sat for that NBC New York interview, which got so much attention. What happened at the office after that interview aired?
Basically, after that aired, we have a lot of officers at the command at the time that show support. Even certain supervisors show support. But none of them will vocalize it because they know to show the support will be detrimental to their career. So, with that being said, the ones that was not showing me support... Hold on a second...
While he deals with that,
yeah, thanks.
There was throughout the NYPD 12 a wave of retaliation that was seen, and it ranged. You know, the interesting thing is the form of the retaliation is sort of at the discretion of supervisors. So we were seeing some officers denied time. You know, in innocuous, subtle ways, denied time off to deal with family issues or to address medical issues or. Removed from, you know, very coveted or hard-earned overtime shifts. In other situations, you know, officers split from their partners and then put on evening shifts alone. And so there was a whole host of ways that have been long practiced by supervisors and commanders in this department. And this tracks back many, many years, you know. Back in the Bloomberg days, for example, officers started off with a negative performance number, right? And so they had to meet certain number of arrest summonses and what was called 250s or stop and frisks. And so in order to then have their performance rating break even or enter into a positive standing or a non-disciplinary standing. And so... this is a systemic issue, and what we're trying to demonstrate in the film is that this is not just one officer's claims; it's many officers. And as Richie was about to, I think, say, was that an outpouring of support came from rank and file and even some commander or supervisors, because everybody knows that this is happening. There's a very interesting individual who came out to our premiere at Sundance, and where we won this incredible award, the Special Jury Award for Social Impact Filmmaking. And we were all very trepidatious when he walked up to us. This is the president of the Sergeants Benevolence Association, somebody who has really risen in the ranks and has a very strong standing and voice in the department. And he said to us, what your film is doing is telling the truth about a long overdue conversation, and I'm going to support this film and its message 1,000%. And we were like, what? Is this a joke? Is this a setup? What is this? And you know, he's really proven that to be true over the months, you know. And one might be cynical and say, okay, this is, you know, he wants to get ahead of sort of the negative message of this and, you know, be on the right side of history, perhaps because the department sees a groundswell grassroots movement unfolding. Fine, even if that, in the most cynical version of what that sort of reaction means, we'll take it, because what we're trying to do is say, hey, let's not just have a conversation about this, but let's throughout the department really be honest about what needs to change, because we're not just trying to quote unquote shed light on an issue, as is so often said, you know, at Q&As for documentaries. You know, perhaps, but we really are trying to shift the policy and address long overdue reforms that have to happen, and, you know, some of which have to be addressed on a state level. For example, the 2010 quota law, as we learn in the film, does not have a legally sustainable pathway for individual litigation or claims of corruption or retaliation or abuse based on a quota system. So the cops at the end of the day, at the end of this film, were not able to sue, because the only way they could address their claims and remediate what they think are these very harmful problems was to go to the department itself. And you can only imagine what that leads to, you know. I mean, that just only outs oneself as now a target.
Right, and we'll talk about that after the break. The judge said that the cops didn't have a right to sue because they didn't come up with enough evidence. And so what he did is he said that the claims about the quotas that there just wasn't enough evidence. So he threw that out of the case, which is the main part of the case. And so we'll get an update on where that is. That is Stephen Meng. He's director of the new documentary, Crime and Punishment. It is about the 12 New York City police officers who have filed a class action suit in federal court to expose and end race-based quotas. And Crime and Punishment debuts on Hulu on August 24th. You can find a link to the Crime and Punishment website and look for community and theater screenings in your area. We're also joined by Richie Baez. He's been a member of the NYPD for 14 years. He's one of the NYPD 12, and he is actually at work, so he just got distracted before the break. But we'll continue to speaking with Richie after a break. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on our media roundtable, we'll speak with The Guardian's Middle East correspondent Martin Chulov about his exclusive interview with Osama bin Laden's family. We'll also talk about the diplomatic fight between Saudi Arabia and Canada over criticism of the kingdom's human rights violations. And we'll talk about the results from Tuesday's primary. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're talking about a new documentary called Crime and Punishment, and it follows the struggles of 12 Black and Latino New York City police officers who have filed a class action lawsuit in federal court to expose and end race-based quotas. Some of these officers said that they were explicitly told to arrest young men of color between the ages of 14 and 21. Stephen Meng is director of Crime and Punishment. The film debuts on Hulu on August 24th. You can visit our website and then go to the Crime and Punishment website to find screenings throughout the country. We're also joined today by Richie Baez. He's been a member of the NYPD for 14 years, and he's one of the NYPD 12 who sued. So, Stephen, we were talking before the break that the judge said the cops had no right to sue. The claims about the quotas were thrown out of the case. Where does the case stand today?
Well, you know, it was very disappointing to learn that the case was actually dismissed and the quota portion was removed from the class action. The attorneys tried to amend the filing and in an attempt to also prove that there was a private cause of action because of the egregious nature of the violation of the quota law, which in some cases judges will exercise their own discretion. But at the end of the day, because of the way that the 2010 quota bill was written, as I mentioned before the break, there was no sustainable legal course of action that they could take ultimately. So, you know, the attorneys don't want to pin this on the judge necessarily, but it really does track back to poorly written legislation.
Richie, what was your response when you heard not only about the judge throwing out the quotas, but the case overall, the case just being thrown out? And how did that really affect the entire force?
Well, me personally and some of the guys on the lawsuit, it was very disheartening. Basically, it shows that even with all these proof that we have, they basically throw it out. I mean, they didn't even look into it. So basically, they found like a loophole to basically skate around it. But I have my faith in God that with the appeal process that it will go through. I mean, many of the great cases, like Brown v. Board of Ed, it went to different appeal cases before it became national law. And other great landmark cases, it took time. You know, it's going to take time for this to happen. So we basically have to stay the course and do it until the end.
And what is work life for you today at the NYPD in the 40th Precinct in the South Bronx? How are you treated today?
You know, basically, is the few officers that know that I'm telling the truth, you know, they stand by. But a lot of the newer officers, they're not aware of how the impact era was. So they basically keep me at arm's length, you know. And like Adele said in the interview, us speaking up, we basically are marked as rats in the department for speaking up. Because we have a culture that we'll complain, but we won't report. We'll complain to each other, but we won't report the injustices and the wrongdoings being done within the department.
And I want to point out, and yet they did speak out. And at the end of the day, I think that what they've proved is that this idea of the blue wall of silence that has prevented very just and righteously minded officers from speaking out across the country about what they see as egregious, you know, abuse of power in many cases. This is a voice that has to be empowered, and that what my hope is that this film and the efforts of the NYPD 12 demystifies the idea that to be a whistleblower in law enforcement is impossible, because they've proven that you can do it. And it's like Richie said, you know, they may not have hit it out of the park with immediate success and victory this first time around, but I think what they've done is jumpstart a conversation that the city and the department has been absolutely resistant and willing to admit is happening. There's this quote that you know, gets used in, you know, police reform space, and I think it's a very fitting one. It's that, you know, Malcolm says that if you put a knife in my back 9 inches and you remove it 6, is that 3 inches progress? And what does it mean for an institution to not even acknowledge that there's even a knife? And so, you know, that's what we're seeing. We're seeing very cosmetic reforms. We saw a tremendous drop in stop and frisk numbers, for example, right? At its height, over 600,000 in 2011, which federal courts deemed unconstitutionally disproportionate in minority communities. And then that activity, productivity measurement or activity goals, as Richie is describing, was transferred elsewhere. You know, there was a huge spike in traffic-related search and seizures, vehicular stops, as they call it, or hotspot policing. And, you know, this is something that public it can't really keep pace with, because the department works with impunity and has absolute discretion in how they want to interpret, you know, the law. And this has to change, because at the end of the day, there is no accountability. There's no way for officers like Richie Baez and the NYPD 12 to make claims of corruption or abuse of power.
Richie, what are your thoughts about de-escalation, and how have efforts around de-escalation changed over the years? Because there's an amazing scene in the film Crime and Punishment. We see footage of Eric Garner's funeral, and Eric Garner was accused of illegally selling cigarettes, and he was killed as NYPD officers wrestled him to the ground and choked him. And this happened in July 2014. This was all caught on video. And right before we see footage of that, we hear from Detective Derek Waller, who's been in the NYPD for 20 years. And there's an interaction that we see between him and a belligerent man outside of a bodega, which is a corner store, in which he diffuses the situation by actually talking to the man and says, okay, man, it's all good. You know, go to a different store. And Derek Waller says that a lot of the new younger officers just don't know how to do that. He says that they're coming in looking for a fight. And he said that if a younger officer had been in that situation, it could have turned out very differently. So have you seen any changes around de-escalation efforts, say, over the last 5 years, simply because of this lawsuit and also because of all of the video that we're seeing of, you know, young men of color who've been killed and or beaten up by police?
Well, with the, let me be on record with the camera. It basically shows what's going on. And basically, a lot of times the camera will exonerate the officers from things that the wrongful things they're being accused of. And also what Derek says, basically, younger officers, they're not being taught by experienced officers like myself or Derek. They're being taught by an officer that has 6 more months more than them. That's the way the job is. They want the young officers to mentor the younger officers. They no longer want guys like me to have experienced, seasoned veterans to guide them, because they can't tell me to do something illegally, or they can't trick me into doing something illegally, or they can manipulate a young mind that out of the academy they're trained to train that whatever the supervisor says is right. That's what they train.
Wow.
And they trained that seasoned officers are we're a bunch of disgruntled, don't know, don't do anything, don't know anything. It's a term called a hair bag. Basically, when you cut somebody's hair, you put it in a bag to throw it out. So they're basically saying that we're garbage, you know, that we're lazy and we don't want to do anything, which is not the case. We know how to pick and choose a battle. We know when to use discretion. Like what Derek did in the film. He saw the guy was angry, you know, and he knew how to defuse it. Mm-hmm. And like defuse the situation, which worked out perfectly. But Derek also says sometimes it may not work out that way. You know, you have to be able to gauge the situation. Once you gauged it, then you can know how to use the appropriate action. My action is always, if it's not physical and people are just angry and they're just yelling, you could tone it down. You know, it's always a very good possibility that you tone it down. once they start getting violent, then you have to use the appropriate force to deal with it. So that's my take on it. And with the de-escalation, the camera does play a big part, but also plays a big part to show what led to the arrest, what led to it getting physical. So I think a majority of the time will exonerate the officers when they use physical force, because it shows what led them to use the physical force.
Stephen, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I think in the case of Eric Garner, that's a perfect example of how broken windows policing, which is a policing theory that Commissioner Bratton has long peddled within the department and the city and across the nation as well, leads to very, very harmful and deadly situations. Because when you take this idea that low-level infractions, if aggressively policed in certain kinds of communities, will then help mitigate larger crimes, you have a situation where that compiled with, you know, the quota where officers are rewarded for meeting a monthly number of arrests and summonses. Well, then, you know, a situation like selling cigarettes, right, untaxed cigarettes, can be a pretext for getting a disorderly or other kinds of criminal summonses. In the situation with Derek Waller in the film that we see, that kind of upset individual who had an individual dispute with somebody, you know, that easily for another officer could have been a pretext to get disorderly conduct, any other kind of various other criminal summonses, and then perhaps a collar or an arrest. And then that officer would be off the hook. Pressure's off him for the month, and he can just now coast. So, sorry, go ahead.
It was just very striking in the film when we hear Officer Felicia Whiteley. She's the only woman involved in the NYPD 12. She's been with the NYPD for 9 years, and she came out and said Eric Garner was killed because of quotas. Richie, do you agree with that?
Yeah, because the whole situation with that, think about it, is that group, I think they're anti-crime. Anti-crime, they deal with felonies, arrests. That's what they look for, mostly, like serious crimes. So, for them to be sent out there was for a number, because they was told to go out there. And that's what a lot of people are missing, that they were told to go out there.
Wow. I also want to talk about another scene in the film involving a conversation between some members of the NYPD 12 and community activists who work on policing issues. Oh, Richie?
Out there, they were told, not by the sergeants, not by the lieutenants, it's commanding officer level and above. Executives was telling them to go out there.
Sorry, Richie, I just lost you for a minute there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Rich, you're at work right now, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks again for taking the time. Richie Baez has been a member of the NYPD for 14 years, and he's at work talking with us about what's going on at the NYPD. Richie, were you involved in that conversation between some of the police officers and community activists?
The scene in the movie, in the
yes.
documentary? Yes,
yeah.
I was there. I was involved.
So this was really interesting to me, because we have spent years doing shows around community policing, activism, Black Lives Matter. I mean, we bring such a wide range of people together at the table. And it was interesting to see the activists say, when we reached out to some fellow activists, they did not want to be in a room with a police officer. They do not want to support what you're doing, because at the end of the day, you are police officers and your job is to carry out these race-based quotas. What was it like for you to sit down with the activists and hear their perspectives?
Wow. Some of it was very... let me see, Tamika, was a pleasure meeting her for the first time, and some of the other people that were there. But when that was said, I was like, wow, it just shows like the divide between law enforcement and the people of color that's happening in this country. And this thing didn't happen overnight. This is decades. So it just showed to me that we have a lot of work to do in order to bridge that gap and to close that divide that is between law enforcement and the community of color.
And I think what is really interesting about that moment in the film is that we really see highlighted this idea that the uniform itself has lost so much respect in communities of color. The delegitimization of the uniform is what leads so much with so many officers across the nation to feel this kind of like vitriolic relationship with the community. And so for too long, there's been this kind of very binary anti-police, pro-law enforcement battle that's being waged. And what we really feel that has never been introduced into that conversation is the voice of people, officers like Richie Baez in the NYPD 12, who actually know what's happening and can speak to those issues on both sides and help move and advance this conversation forward. And so that's what we really hope that this film can help highlight, that, you know, it's just long overdue for rank and file to have a way to voice their, disagreements about policies. Because at the end of the day, the policies come from on high. The mayor, the commissioner, the chiefs of any department will determine what then officers on the front lines who are engaging and interfacing with the community have to do. And so they will be on the receiving end of any kind of pushback or worse.
Richie, what is your relationship like today with community activists, especially those who track police activity?
I don't have a relationship with them.
Hmm.
It's not like how can I say? After the meeting, the only group that I went to a few meetings afterwards would be the Justice League with Tamika. The other people in the group I have not met afterwards.
And when you do your patrols, when you're out talking to community members, I'm sure that so many people know about the NYPD 12 lawsuit. Maybe some of them know that you're one of the officers who sued. Has your relationship with community members just out in your day, has that changed? Has that been affected?
The ones that do know, they appreciate it. But the ones that do not know, they appreciate me because the way I carry myself is not that I changed because I did the interview. I always carry myself with the sense that I'm here to serve the community. I'm here to serve the community and protect and serve and to help people with their problems. That's what basically I'm here for. And there's a problem that does not involve me have to arrest the person, or I might add that I have to write them a summons. I'll try to solve their problems, give them answers. If I don't have the answers, I can find out where I can direct them that they can go there and find the solutions to their problems.
And Richie, after all of this, what would you say to someone who says, why are you still with the NYPD if you oppose these practices?
Well, due to my, my Judeo-Christian background, you know, being a police officer is an honorable profession. You know, even if something is being done wrong, it's my job to uphold the law and do the right thing. I'm doing the right thing by speaking up against it and suing, because at the end of the day, it's not to help me or the other 12 officers, it's to help law enforcement and the community to build that bridge between the two and to foster a more healthy relationship. Yeah, because at the end of the day, all the policies that's being written and sanctified is coming from above the law enforcement, because law enforcement is not an entity that operates by itself. We have someone to answer to, and that comes from the city level, which goes down to the PC and trickles its way down to us.
Stephen, when we started the show, you talked about the positive reaction you got from an officer who saw the film at Sundance. What have you heard from activists with, like, Black Lives Matter, for example, and other groups that hold police accountable?
It's been a really interesting reaction. You know, I was a little nervous. You know, there in the activism space, there's a broad spectrum of feelings about police reform that range from actual, you know, common sense, you know, reform measures to full-on abolitionism. And I did not expect that abolitionists in the movement would respond positively or want to embrace the film because of this very idea that Richie is talking about, that there's such great mistrust and for law enforcement. But they've really been embracing the film and have come up to me in large numbers saying that they didn't expect that they would like these officers and the message of this film as much as they do. And so I'm really encouraged that I think this is a film that we've heard from law enforcement, from ranking officers in the department, as well as the furthest extreme of abolitionist activists who believe that this is a conversation, a variation on the conversation they've never heard before.
And finally, we hear a lot about the chain of command, and you just wonder at the end of the day who really has the power to change things. And there's another great scene in the film, Officer Edwin Raymond, who's a Black officer, young, really amazing guy. He talks about Bill de Blasio's progressive policies, and he says, what is the point of universal pre-K when in 12 years down the road, that four-year-old will be swept up in a quota system? And then you hear from Anthony Miranda, president of the Latino Officers Association, who says it's not de Blasio's fault. The system has been around long before de Blasio. Stephen, what's your take on this? Has anything changed under de Blasio, and who really has the power to stop these quotas?
No.
Just about a minute.
Sure. Nothing has changed. You know, the problem is that we're in a much more complicated moment because the department in the city is actually acknowledging the need for reforms. It's acknowledged these kind of critical race problems that exist within police-community relations. And yet the response and the reforms have actually not addressed any root problems. And so for at the end of the day, this is about a structural issue in the department and the city. This relationship between policing and revenue and numbers-driven, compstat-driven, quota-based policing, and this inability to fight back because of a lack of independent investigative agencies, not just in New York but throughout the country, to really be a place for claims by law enforcement and the community to be considered and investigated.
Stephen Mang is director of Crime and Punishment. It debuts on Hulu on August 24th. If you're in the Bay Area, you can see it at the Roxy in San Francisco on August 31st. And then you can find other screenings across the country and maybe hold a community screening yourself. Find information at yourcallradio.org. Stephen, thank you for making this film, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Richie Baez has been a member of the NYPD for 14 years. He is one of the 12 officers who filed a class action lawsuit. Richie, thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you on again to talk more about police reform and accountability. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on this show.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us, and thanks for sticking with us at the top of the hour through these technical issues. You can find more information about the film and Your Call at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing the show. Thanks for joining us. It's Your Call.